Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. It's going to be a busy weekend for us as there are a couple resource conferences in Vancouver that Chad and I are both attending. So posting on Monday will definitely be a bit lighter, but that is because we are taking time to meet with a lot of resource companies, a lot of juniors that are coming into Vancouver. We'll keep you all up to date on the meetings we have, and please keep in touch with us in terms of companies that you think we should be swinging by their booth or setting up extra meetings with. We will for sure do that and follow up with all of you. To kick off this show, happy to report, we have Rick Rule back on the show, founder of Rule Investment Media. Now, Rick, we're going to go around the horn here, a number of different commodities we're going to talk about, and I really want to start with the one topic that is first and foremost on a lot of precious metals investors' minds. That is how you are seeing the value or market cap of gold stocks, gold equities, to the underlying gold price. It's been years that we've had many gold commentators say, we haven't seen stocks this cheap compared to where the gold price is. Unfortunately, it seems like this disconnect is growing almost. Rick, how do you view value of gold stocks to where the gold price is?
Well, arithmetically, if you don't believe that the gold and silver price is going to fall, arithmetically, it's arguable that the market capitalizations of gold and silver companies relative to the underlying commodity price is the cheapest that it's been in 50 years. Commentators say that that has to do with the market's anticipation of a decline in inflation and the fact that gold, from their point of view, is no longer necessary. They will suggest that the price of gold equities suggests that the price of gold will decline. My own suspicion is that they're wrong and that gold and silver equities prices are, in fact, cheap. And I would like, if it's permissible, Corey and Chad, to defend that thesis briefly.
By all means, please.
In the first instance, inflation, as measured by the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, I think is a misnomer. The CPI is, by anybody's estimation, a constructed index for at least three reasons. The first is that it's hedonistically adjusted, which is to say it doesn't take into account the cost of living, but rather adjusts the so-called cost of living by bureaucrats figuring what the true value of your apartment or home is and what the utility that they can attribute to your computer is, which is to say it doesn't measure the real cost of the goods and service, but rather the imputed value delivered. It's a manufactured index. The second thing is, when it's inconvenient, it doesn't measure food or fuel. I guess that's okay for people who don't drive, fly, or eat. But for most people, a CPI that purports to be a cost of living index that doesn't measure food or fuel is irrelevant. But the biggest problem that I see with the CPI as a measure of the deterioration of purchasing power, which is the other way of saying inflation, is that it doesn't include the impact of tax. For almost all of your listeners, gentlemen, tax constitutes their largest cost of living expense, larger than housing, larger than energy, larger than transportation, and larger than food combined. And the idea that the CPI is construed as a cost of living index when it doesn't include the largest cost component, and by the way, the fastest increasing cost component of any of the components, suggests that the CPI is in fact a lie. When I back-tested my own expenditures, admittedly crudely, over the last 5 years, what I learned to my chagrin was that the basket of goods and services that I personally consume is increasing at price at about 7% compounded, which is a different way of saying that the present value of my savings and the present value of my income is deteriorating in terms of consistent purchasing power by about 7% compounded. What that means is that if you are planning your future lifestyle and you are using the CPI number at 2.7, you are understating the impact of inflation on your personal budget by in excess of 4% a year. I watched exactly the same circumstance occur early in my career in the early part of the decade of the 70s. The outlook for inflation was crystal clear to anybody who cared to look, but people were lulled into a sense of security by the beneficent economic climate that we enjoyed in the 50s and 60s. And I would suggest to you, gentlemen, that people's expectation of inflation in the future has been not tempered, but rather stilted by the fact that we've gone through probably 40 years of the most benign economic climate in human history. And I think that when the reality of a deterioration of purchasing power at 7% comes into conflict with the expectation set by a 2.6 or 2.7 CPI number, that the realization of the importance of hedging accounts to inflation will become very, very, very apparent to people. My suspicion is that the circumstance that we have seen in 2023 mirrors the market circumstance that we saw in 1975. In 1975, an increase in nominal interest rates clobbered the gold price and clobbered the gold stocks, despite the fact that we were in a 10-year-long bull market. Late in 1975, when the Fed lost its nerve and lowered interest rates, then gold and silver stocks were in fact off to the races. I'm not suggesting that in 2024, gold and silver stocks will be off to the races. I am merely suggesting that inflation is likely more persistent and higher than people believe. And as the narrative changes from inflation has been tempered to inflation will be with us for a substantial period of time, particularly if that's accompanied by lower interest rates, I think that you will see gold and silver and gold and silver stocks do very well. One other fact is that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related investments is the lowest that it has been in my lifetime. It is estimated by J.P. Morgan Chase, no friend of gold and silver, that the market share of precious metals related investments in the U.S. savings and investment market is about 0.5%, which is to say 0.5% of all the savings and investment assets in the United States are denominated in gold and silver. This is down from a four-decade mean of 2%. If gold and silver were to return to their four-decade mean, which is what I think will happen, then demand for precious metals-related assets, both bullion and stocks, will quadruple. And I think that that will occur within the five-year time frame. So I personally am attracted to gold and silver stocks. Does that mean that your listeners should cash in all of their investments and go out and buy penny dreadfuls with the money? Of course not. The truth is that these are some of the most volatile asset classes known to humankind. And a fairly small investment in gold and silver in the type of market that we saw in the 1970s will shield a portfolio from all kinds of sin elsewhere. Don't overinvest in a theme, no matter what the theme is. But my suspicion is that gold and silver are out of favor because people are backward-looking, not forward-looking, but not backward-looking enough that they take into account history that happened in the 1970s. Rather, backward-looking enough that they only take into account what happened in 2021, 22, and 23.
Yeah, Rick, some great points on inflation, how it's calculated versus the reality most people are facing. And it's an interesting time where we've seen, as you say, one of the most aggressive rate hiking cycles. And now, even if they shift to a more loose monetary policy and start cutting, it seems like inflation may be stickier. To the point about the gold stocks having such low valuations, a lot of people point to the dilution the sector has had over, let's say, the last decade, where gold has channeled sideways from that 1921 top in 2011, hit over 2000 again in 2020, again in 2022, and again last year, and looks to be close to breaking out. But they're saying, look how much dilution the sector has had. then again, there's been a lot of value creation with acquisitions and buying projects, but then there's also the cost factor. The costs have crept up, but we've seen inflation moderate and we've seen the metals prices break out. Will it take a big breakout, let's say a couple hundred dollars in the gold price or a couple bucks in the silver price to really fatten up the margins? Or do you think that the valuations are divorced for something beyond just dilution and cost?
3 points to that. The first is that if you're investing in the gold and silver sector in the bullion, you don't care too much about corporate performance. From my point of view, people who don't own a little bit of gold and silver bullion, if for no other purpose than insurance purposes, are people that really need to examine their investment performance, meaning I think that people need to do it. If you look at the stocks, one of the things that's held them back, I think, is the anticipation of failure. That anticipation was born more, I think, in the decade 2000 to 2010, where the corporate underperformance of precious metals companies at all valuation levels, which is to say penny dreadfuls all the way through the best of the best, could best be described as horrific. The truth is that if you look at that decade, the gold and silver, the gold price advanced from $256 to $1,950, and the free cash flow per share in the XAU declined. It took real skill to mismanage a price move of that magnitude as badly as they did. I will point out to the pessimists, however, that virtually without exception, the management teams that presided over that destruction of value were thanked and excused, allowed to pursue other employment opportunities. And I would suggest to you that the industry is better led now than it was then. It would be impossible to be worse led. But I would suggest to you also that the investors in this space are much less tolerant of corporate shenanigans than there were in the past. That notwithstanding, Corey, we have talked on your show before, going back 20 years to the Corlin days, about the fact that you need to be particularly in the more speculative part of the market, the part that will be in evidence at the VRIC, that probably 85% of the companies in the sector have no value. They're lifestyle companies. They're not gold or silver companies. So it's important to understand that you can't buy the sector in the juniors. If you do, you will lose money. The truth is, I believe that at least 85% of the companies in the sector are valueless. That disguises the fact that the 15% remnant generate so much performance that they add luster and occasionally even luster to a sector where 85% of the population is totally useless. What that means is that as you go searching for alpha in the sector, which is when you hang out in Vancouver, when you look to the juniors, stock selection is everything. My suggestion to you is that those investors who are looking for beta, which I would describe as the outperformance of a sector relative to the broad market, that you can buy the top 5 or 10 companies in the sector if you have a 5-year holding period with relative impunity. I'm not suggesting necessarily that you can buy the index, but certainly I think that you can buy 5 or 6 very high quality names with fortress balance sheets, and you can buy them with absolute impunity today.
So Rick, what are some of the higher quality names in terms of characteristics of the stocks then? Because it's such a wide world out there. How do you go about filtering down what are either red flags or what, I guess even more so, stands out to you as a quality issuer?
Well, I think Franco-Nevada is unusually cheap today. The problems around Cobre Panama, which constitute 15% of the net present value of Franco-Nevada, has caused the stock to fall by 40%, which is to say the succession of production at a deposit which accounted for 15% of the net present value of the issuer has caused the issuer price to decline by 40%. This is the highest quality gold company in the world. And by the way, I don't think that the final chapter in the Cobre Panama story has been written. I think that there will be a recovery either via international arbitration or much more likely a political accommodation between First Quantum and the nation of Panama. So I would suggest to you that the highest quality gold company in the world is anomalously underpriced as a consequence of an overreaction to the occurrence of risk. In second place, I probably would put Wheaton Precious. a streaming company where the cost component of what they do is already baked in the cake, where you don't take operational risk, but you merely participate in the upside inherent in very large projects geologically and also in precious metals prices. Moving down the quality trail a little bit, if you are willing to take a bit more operational risk, I think you need to look at a name like Barrick. Barrick will likely sell off if they are successful at taking over First Quantum, because investors would rather see the money that they would spend to develop Reko Diq and Cobre Panama return to shareholders by way of buybacks or dividends. But the truth is that both of these activities, while holding political risk, are extraordinarily accretive to the company in the 5, 6, and 7 year bases. Agnico Eagle, it appears to me, simply goes from strength to strength. And I think that that's certainly a name that would be attractive from a beta viewpoint. And the recent acquisition by Newmont of Newcrest is one that hasn't been treated well by the market. But I think the rationalization of the combined companies, the ability of the company to sell off tier two projects, to strengthen the balance sheet and allow management's time and attention to be focused on the biggest and best assets in their portfolio, is one that over the 4 or 5 year time frame will treat shareholders extremely, extremely well. Those are a smattering of names. If you want to take a bit more risk, I think the recent sell-off in Endeavor Mining as a consequence of the termination of that company's CEO for alleged financial improprieties has caused a company which has been a serial outperformer for 10 years to become anomalously cheap. It is true that one, when considering Endeavor, needs to determine how deep the financial rot was and whether the examination into the company's finances will uncover any wrongdoing in concession acquisition in Africa. This is a riskier name, but it's certainly very, very, very cheap. And for people who can afford to take more risk, there are lots of opportunities in the single asset producers or the intermediate producers, where in the event that the gold price even holds steady, either their share prices rise or they are taken over by larger companies with more liquidity and a lower cost of capital. A wonderful set of circumstances. What's really changed for me personally, Corey, and this may or may not resonate with your viewers, is really since 2010, I've been out of the hyper junior market. I've been out of the sub 10 million market cap market because I didn't think that market was demonstrably cheaper on a net asset value basis than the less risky companies. And I felt myself that the terms involved in private placements in the hyper cheap companies were too expensive. They didn't factor in the risk that the investor was taking. Just in the last 4 or 5 weeks, I've seen private placement offerings come around from companies that frankly had to raise money that I felt compensated me for the risk that I was taking in putting that money up. So I'm looking forward at the VRIC and later at my own conference to walking around the exhibit hall and really getting to know the hyper risky, hyper speculative side of the market. Again, that's where I cut my teeth. So I'm going to spend 2024, I think, looking at places that other people don't look at. I'm very much back in a risk-on circumstance. I'm back in a market looking for 10-baggers and 15-baggers, hopefully 10-baggers and 15-baggers with a full warrant, knowing that I will lose more times than I succeed, which is to say out of 10 starts, I'll probably lose money 6 or 7 times, 20 or 30% of the money that I invest. But hopefully in 1 or 2 of those 10, I'll get a 10-bagger. If you get a 10-bagger with a full warrant, it's important to know that you didn't get a 10-bagger. You got a 15-bagger or something like that. So I'm back in the game, Corey, in terms of looking at the hyper-speculative part of the market and thinking more about my upside than about my downside.
Well, Rick, just to the point of looking at the juniors and the hyper-speculative side of the market, you've made the point in many interviews and on our show before that your background was as a credit analyst, not as an economist, but you do look at, you know, lending money to companies and the terms, and with the interest rate environment where it is, with the sector sentiment as depressed as it is, and with it really being a story of the haves and the have-nots, there are quality companies, quality management teams that have access to capital that have been able to raise sometimes pretty dilutive raises, but still they've been able to build value. And there is a huge swath, maybe that's that 85% you were referring to, that have just really struggled to raise any money at all. We've been wondering, is there even going to be any work programs in 2024? Because so many companies don't even have the funds to keep the lights on, much less really fund an aggressive exploration or development project. How are you looking at the setup between, I guess, the haves, the companies that do have big work programs set up this year but have already raised capital, versus the have-nots that have their hand out looking to raise money in a very tough market?
If I'm right, unfortunately, the have-nots will survive. That sounds very harsh. My suspicion is that 2024 and 2025 will be pretty good markets, and they'll be led by those that are deserving. The share price performance of the deserving will probably, unfortunately, lead to hope among uninformed check writers who will keep the lame, the halt, and the blind, the 85% of those companies existing that don't exist, don't deserve to exist, will probably keep them alive. I say unfortunately, not because I don't feel for the employees of those companies who I believe deservedly should lose their jobs, but rather because I think if the industry was rational in terms of capital allocation and more money went to deserving people with deserving projects, that the investor in the industry itself would be better served. You may recall, Corey, in an earlier interview that we did, probably 10 years ago, I described the fact that an intern for us once took 25 then VSE companies, that'll tell you how long it was ago, now TSXV companies, at random, and looked at the balance sheet and income statement and found that for the 25 companies selected at random, more than 60% of the money raised was consumed by general and administrative expense, and only 40% went in the ground. If you start with the postulation that exploration is a risky business to begin with, and then you burden the exploration expenditure by a 60% G&A charge, you can see that the expectation of success in exploration for those companies is functionally zero. So when you describe a circumstance where the have-nots go begging for capital, I think that's extremely healthy. And I hate to say, and this will obviously get me a lot of hate at the VRIC, but I hope that 2024 and 2025 are years that are discriminating enough that we see 1,000 companies go to company heaven. I don't suspect that that will happen, but that would be a realization of my fondest dreams.
Well, if history is any guide for us, we all know that these companies are going to survive somehow. But Rick, one argument that we have heard within the especially gold sector, but resource sector broadly, is that companies aren't innovative enough. They're not marketing the right way. They're not utilizing new tools. They're not developing new tools to either find metals better, produce metals better, what have you. What's your thought on this concept that, yes, the market doesn't care, but it's also on the companies and the sector to be better and do better things?
I think that's a wonderful comment. Let's look at it a few ways. I would suggest that particularly with the TSXV, for 40 years, too much onus has been spent on taking a 25-cent stock to 43.5 cents, which is to say that too many management teams have recycled a project which has failed in the last four booms, a project that had one good drill hole in it. And what the management team does in the first instance is that they option the property. And secondly, they twin that one good hole. This isn't exploration. This is stock promotion. This isn't geared at all to achieving exploration success, but rather to lowering their cost of capital and ensuring that their salary is maintained for 18 months to 2 years. And certainly my hope would be that that falls aside. My suspicion too, and this will be unpopular, I think, among your listeners, is that speculators and managers both need to fear political risk less than technical risk. It is true that the politics of emerging and frontier markets is less understood and more tenuous than the politics around the United States and Canada. But it is also true that really, truly world-scale deposits will be more frequently discovered in places with great prospectivity, but less competition. And I think the industry and the investors, too, need to emphasize technical success more than they need to emphasize political risk. I would suggest to you that every single political jurisdiction in the world is risky, that there is no safe jurisdiction in the world. I personally have been treated much better in places like Congo and Chile than I have in California or other states in the United States. And so I think that the market needs to take into account real risk as opposed to other risk. And I also believe that it's incumbent on capital markets and capital markets participants not to keep metaphorically passing the collection plate through the choir, but rather to expand the congregation. In my own business, Rural Investment Media, I've been very active on social media. That was partly an outgrowth of my former work at Sprott, where in 2011, 2012, we noticed that our investor market was mostly comprised of people who look like me, old, bald, fat, white, rich males. And the fact is that demographic was identified as really, truly dying. When, as a consequence really of trying to lower the cost of reaching those consumers, we began to adopt a social media policy, what we found is that the potential market was much broader than the market we were serving, to the extent that now my 80,000 subscribers at Rural Investment Media, at least those subscribers who we've added in the last 3 years, are predominantly under the age of 40 and are 35% female. They are very often non-white. If a 70-year-old person like myself can expand his audience from 5,000 people to 80,000 people and can experience growth in every single demographic area and in every single geography in the world, the mining industry can do it too. It is too common for the lifestyle promoters in Vancouver merely to circulate the collection plate through the choir in good markets and then live off the accumulated capital during the bad markets. And the industry needs to be much more innovative in terms of accessing pools of capital that exist where those capital pools do exist. I myself have been extraordinarily successful at this. And if an old 70-year-old dinosaur like myself can do it, certainly the young, aggressive, smart management teams that inhabit some of the companies in this space can do it too.
Great comments, Rick, on widening the scope of the audience for the sector and getting a more diverse group of people when that collection plate does go around. One other question we want to work in here real quick is about M&A. We've seen over the last year or two, really the big focus has been the big boys acquiring the big boys. Just to your point earlier about some of the quality stocks at the top of the batting order, you know, Newmont acquiring Newcrest, Barrick going after First Quantum, Agnico Eagle acquiring Kirkland Lake. It's really been those kind of mega mergers that have fueled, and we've seen that in the base metals too. There have been a handful of deals of single asset producers being scooped up or development projects being scooped up, but they've been few and far between. Do you anticipate seeing more activity where those single asset producers or development projects finally get grabbed by maybe the mid-tiers or maybe some of the other producers in the year to come?
Yes, yes, and yes. Right now, the hyper majors have much more volume and much more trading liquidity, which means they have a lower cost of capital than the intermediate producers. Either the intermediate producers' share prices rise or the senior producers will take them over. Similarly, single asset producers have less trading liquidity than intermediate producers and much less trading liquidity than the hyper majors. Unless their share prices go up, they will certainly be taken over. But it's important that everybody understand that this M&A is extremely healthy for the sector. Larger asset sizes, larger trading floats, larger trading volumes raise share prices, which lowers cost of capital. Cost of capital is a determinant of success in a capital-intensive business. Two, an intelligently constructed merger lowers the general and administrative cost relative to assets under management and relative to EBIT, which is to say the companies with size become more efficient. Two, the larger companies are able to sell their second tier assets and focus on their high quality assets, which is a very important thing. Where the M&A cycle should be occurring among the juniors is where it's not occurring. The need for scope and scale, the need for reduced G&A, the need to focus on high quality assets is most acute in the juniors. Unfortunately, among the juniors, the resistance to M&A is the highest. And this is because of management's intransigence. In every acquisition, there's a winning team and a losing team. The losing team may be compensated for losing, but the truth is that they lose both their dream and, to them, more importantly, their salary. So the sector of the market that needs the M&A the most is unfortunately the sector that will see it the least.
Well, Rick, before I get you out of here, I know that you have a special invitation for our listeners. Please share that with us.
If they go to Rural Investment Media, they can list their natural resource stocks, and I will personally rank them. No charge, no obligation. Go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks. I will personally rank them 1 to 10. I'll comment on issues where I think my comments might have value. Please, no crypto. Please, no pot stocks. Please, no tech stocks. Let an old man do what he does best, which is natural resource stocks. Rural Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks. I will personally rank them.
Rick, thank you so much. That's so valuable. I will post a link to Rural Investment Media. I hope all of you, our listeners, take Rick up on that offer. Always a pleasure chatting with you. And hey, I greatly appreciate your honesty, whether listeners like it or not. You've been around for quite a while in these markets, and you've always told it kind of the way it is, but interesting to hear that you are starting to get a bit more aggressive in almost the micro cap juniors. Sounds like because the terms are just so attractive. Boy, oh boy, we've seen companies really, really desperate to raise money. So Rick, I'm going to be having you back on this show next month in February. We're also going to be seeing you in Vancouver very soon. Safe travels up to Vancouver. And Rick, again, thank you so much for your time on this weekend show.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.